Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec from Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody. You know there's a lot going on. Certainly today, again, this week, the last couple of weeks when it comes to banks, Deutsche Bank under pressure. We've seen it down the most in 3 years and the cost of insuring its debt against default rising. In a sell-off, though, that Citigroup analysts describe as irrational. Clock two ticking on bids for Silicon Valley Bridge Bank. 8 p.m. Wall Street time tonight. Meantime, shares of First Republic. We continue to wonder about what's next for this one. It's down about 90% year to date. So our next guest has been following and covering the bank sector for decades. He was a go-to for many of us here at Bloomberg during the great financial crisis, still is a go-to when it comes to things in the banking world. Chris Whalen is institutional risk analyst at Whalen Global Advisors, an investment banker who focuses on the banking, mortgage, finance, and fintech sectors. He's authors, author of several books. Chris, you have quite a resume. He's worked at the New York Fed, up on Capitol Hill, at Bear Stearns, at Kroll Bond Rating, at Institutional Risk Analytics. This is why we have him here on this Friday. He joins us on the phone in New York City. Chris, really grateful for you for joining us on what's been a busy, busy week. We all learned and leaned on you during the 2008 bank and mortgage crisis. Are there any similarities to today and to then?
No, it's actually quite different, Carolyn. Hello.
Hello.
You know, for a decade, the Fed made it so that credit didn't matter. So you didn't have to call me, right?
Yeah, that's true.
The bond market didn't matter. The Fed took it off the table, right? And now it's back on the table in a huge way. I would compare this more to December 2018, which was a crisis in the money markets, except this time the crisis is really measured by the 10-year Treasury. So if you go back to the third quarter when the banks reported that really ugly number for unrealized losses on their securities, and people finally started paying attention to that, and they said, oh, you know, $800 billion, that's a lot of money, right? It got better in the fourth quarter because we had a bond rally. This quarter, it's going to look a little better, too. But the problem hasn't gone away because during 2020-21, we packed three-quarters of the mortgage market into a range of about 2.5-3% in terms of coupons. So if you know, you own a Ginnie Mae 3, and the Fed raises Fed funds 6 points, what happens to that security? It trades in the 70s. And this is why banks are having a problem. Now, forget about the securities, which we can see. It's called accumulated other comprehensive income, and it's a number that's negative right now, a big number. But everybody's worried about the loan book, too, because they have the same problem. The loans from that period when we were fighting COVID are now deep underwater, 20 points underwater.
You write, you have a note out that you put, I believe it was yesterday, and you note, by doubling the Fed's balance sheet between 2020 and 2021 from over $4 trillion to now $9 trillion in nominal dollars, the FOMC has injected vast amounts of market risk into the U.S. banking system. Okay, that's a lot of risk. So do we yet know how this ends?
Well, the Fed is going to have to drop rates, Carol, very simply, and I'll tell you why. The small banks out there who are trying to hold the most important customers they have, which is their business customers, are fighting a losing battle Because let's say I'm paying them 2% now mm-hmm. on their balances, and I'm even arranging ways to give them yield on their escrows, their payroll balances, stuff that normally we don't pay interest on, right? But they can get 4% on a T-bill. And so they come into the office, they sit down with you, and they say, Carol, I can get 4% on a T-bill. Why should I keep my money with you? Powell and the Fed have been insensitive to the fact that they execute monetary policy through the bond market. And when they did QE in 2020 and 21, not only did they cause a problem for the banks, but they tied their own hands. And yet they want to pretend that they didn't. You see?
Mm-hmm.
Right now, if you look at the 10-year, it's headed back to 3%.
Mm-hmm.
What should the Fed be doing right now, Carol? They should be selling mortgage-backed securities. They should peg that 10-year to about, 3.5 and say to the desk in New York, if it goes below 3.5, sell.
Right.
When I worked at the Fed, we could do things like that. But the Fed today is so bureaucratic and so ossified that not only do they not know what's going on in the markets, but they model liquidity. You know how they model it? Versus GDP. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
A GDP model is not going to give you the answer you want.
Right, right. I'm going to get you in too. Just come on in. Yeah.
Chris, I was eager to hear from you about this because when I've been speaking with portfolio managers looking more longer out, some of them are thinking when they're looking and seeing where certain banks are trading at, even brokerages, they're kind of eager to potentially step in and start buying. But what concerns them, and you brought it up, is that yield curve. How much more pain do you think, even though we've seen some steepening happening there, do you think that really bodes for banks right now?
Well, like I say, until the Fed relents and has a discussion not only with us in the market, but with Congress, and I think they have avoided doing this because they don't want to talk to Congress. They think they can make decisions on their own. They're wrong. The biggest problem with the Fed today is hubris. They have to realize that they are not allowed to make certain decisions, and when they don't have an answer, or if policy is tied their hands in some ways, they need to go back to Capitol Hill and get some guidance. You know, what they've done to the bond market, frankly, is almost bordering on the criminal because it'll take generations to fix this. I'll give you an example from my own world. I have a 3% mortgage that's sitting in a Fannie Mae pool.
Right.
That mortgage will not be in the money again in my lifetime unless we drive rates down to nothing. We'd have to drive rates back down to 2%. For that 3 to be refinanceable.
But Chris, help me out, because part of the conversations and the narrative that we've certainly been having is that the low rate environment that we had was the abnormal environment, that's
yeah.
not typical. So how was the Fed supposed to kind of come out of that and get back to a more normal rate environment?
You can't. I mean, Ben Bernanke, in the early conversations with the FOMC about quantitative easing, basically told them this.
Mm-hmm.
He said, once you go down this road, you can't come back. And it doesn't matter whether you're talking about the balance sheet and reducing the size of the balance sheet. If you take too much liquidity out, the market seizes up because they got used to it. You know, you gave them $5-6 trillion that they didn't have before. Also, the price aspect of this, as we discussed earlier, is very difficult to deal with, because if 3/4 of the mortgage market is locked up in these low coupons, not only is it impossible to fund this paper, SOFR is at 4.5% today.
Right.
That means, figure repos another point above it. How do you finance a Ginnie Mae 2?
Right.
You don't.
Right.
And the volatility of these low coupon securities, because so much of the repayment is back-ended, right? As you guys know this at Bloomberg better than everybody. A low coupon security is more volatile than a high coupon security. So nobody wants to own this paper. Honestly, you want a solution? We can fix this next week. The Fed should buy all that paper back.
Wow.
Okay?
Wow. Yeah.
At par.
Wow.
They should buy it all back at par. And then they have to go up to Capitol Hill and say, we were trying to deal with a icky situation. We had people on the Hill screaming, do something, save the economy, right? And we did. But now we have a mess.
Well, what do you think Janet Yellen and Jay Powell and other regulators who are now meeting in an unscheduled meeting, and we expect something out from them, do you, any indications of what they're talking about? Because it does feel like there's been some shoring up in the markets for whatever reason.
They keep trying to throw solutions, but every time the Fed takes a step, they create another problem. You see? They have a very blunt instrument. And honestly, you know, I deal with a lot of federal agencies in Washington. Mm-hmm. The Biden administration has the weakest team in terms of financial market knowledge and experience that I can remember in my lifetime. You know, the people I worked with at the Fed of New York, like Paul Volcker and Jerry mm-hmm. Corrigan, they knew markets, okay? They knew how to clean up messes. And they also understood the limits of monetary policy. And again, remember, the Fed executes monetary policy in the bond market. So if you go big, which is what they did after 2018, because mm-hmm. they didn't want another liquidity crisis, right? Their intentions
right.
were good.
Right.
But by doing that, today, that $3 trillion of mortgage-backed securities that they own is really bigger than their Treasury portfolio, if you measure the duration. It's more like $12 to $15 trillion. And that's one reason why that 10-year note doesn't want to go above 4%. The Fed owns all the duration, and they don't hedge that book. It's entirely passive. So they've done structural things to our marketplace that will literally take generations to fix. And I'm very concerned about this. I think that we need to put some limitations on what the Fed does. And when the Fed gets to those limits, they got to go back up to Capitol Hill and have a public conversation. They can't do this behind closed doors.
Chris, I want to bring Jess in because we were talking in the break about what we're hearing from some of the Fed speakers or former, if you will, and what they are talking about where the Fed is going.
Looking at Jim Bullard earlier this morning talking about it. Peak potential terminal rate around 5.6%. It's interesting because you were talking about how you think the Fed should cut rates. What sort of implications could there be if we don't actually see that from the Fed and what that means for equities?
Well, if the Fed takes rates up to where Jim Bullard has just said, then look out. I think we're going to have a meltdown in the banking industry.
Mm.
See, what's happening right now is even if you ignore the price action in these securities, a lot of banks are underwater mm-hmm. on some of this
yeah.
paper.
Mm-hmm.
And so the treasurer of the bank's going to walk into the room at some point screaming and saying, you got to sell this paper now. I have to reinvest at a higher rate or we're going to go out of business. And then when you have instability on the funding side, that makes life even more complicated. So the clock is ticking. And the Fed can provide all sorts of liquidity measures and everything else, but they're going to expand their balance sheet, as we've already seen. I think, honestly, there's a kind of a false conversation, a false narrative in the U.S. that somehow we can keep inflation low. Mm-hmm. The society loves inflation. Come on. You know, we have to get to the point where we can actually get Congress to fix Humphrey Hawkins, drop the full employment part of the mandate, and let's remember the third mandate that we never talk about, which was stable long-term interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? In the old days, when inflation was a problem, when I was a kid, we worried about such things. We don't do that now because everybody just assumes we could do whatever we want. You know, the dollar won. After 2008, you can see this on the Bloomberg, what happened to swaps? Dollar fixed floating swaps. It went into a discount. There's no other country in the world that has that gift, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But we have it. So we keep pushing the limits on spending, on deficits, on everything else. We're going to lose that. And we're going to be like everyone else. So I think that this conversation about inflation versus growth has got to come back to Washington, go back up to Capitol Hill, and say, how can we give the Fed a mandate that they can actually accomplish? Because let's be fair, the 2% target for inflation is a joke. We're not going to get back there.
Yeah, and we've had a lot of conversations about that doesn't make sense. We've also talked about, you know, Chris, and I don't know how you think about what this means for the U.S. dollar specifically. We've got a great, Simon White did a great column on Bloomberg, and he just talked about the dollar being the liability of the central bank. And if we continue to see what we're seeing in terms of what feels like, you know, certainly moral hazard for banks, that he talks about further erosion of the dollar's value and that how that would really kill the purchasing power that we've seen of the U.S. currency over the last century. I mean, there's so many implications.
It's a complicated mess.
There is not
one answer here, and it's very important to state that. And we got to realize the folks at the Fed are trying very honestly and I think in a very genuine way mm-hmm. to do their jobs. But imagine sitting behind those closed doors dealing with what they're looking at today.
So what do we hear from, what would you like to hear from Janet Yellen? What does she need to say maybe today?
I think she needs to announce she's going back to the private life. We need another Secretary of the Treasury, and I got the candidate, Sheila Bair, a nice progressive Republican from Kansas who could easily be confirmed by the Senate tomorrow, who understands finance. You know, there's only two people at senior agency levels in Washington today that know what's going on. One is Marty Gruenberg at the FDIC, who's the most senior regulator in the system, mm-hmm. and the other is Sandra Thompson over at the FHFA, who's a veteran of the FDIC, worked at Resolution Trust, worked at Goldman Sachs. These people know what's going on. The rest of this cast of characters are politicians.
Well,
they
don't
have the shoes for this.
During the crisis, we know Jamie Dimon, well, first of all, has gone up and talked with the Treasury Secretary this time around. During the crisis, sure. I think there was a lot of conversations, as you well know, between government and the banks and the private sector, if you will. Is any of that happening now that you're aware of?
Not as much as it needs to happen. You know, when I worked at the Fed, we always talked to the people in bank supervision. They don't do that now. Fed governors never talk to the people down the hallway at Soup and Reg and say, how is our policy impacting the financial markets? How is our policy impacting banks? They never ask that question. So I think there's a level of isolation and a lack of information in this data-dependent central bank of ours that's really something we need to work on. Hmm. They need to know how their policies are going to affect the bond market. You know, what happens if this 10-year goes below 3%? And we're sitting here talking about low inflation.
Yeah, no, you're right.
And looking at the 2-year as well, where that's trading. When you're talking about the potential pain that could be on the way, Chris, what other cracks are you seeing beginning to emerge under the hood when it comes to financial institutions right now?
Well, anyone who owns bonds with leverage has a problem. So REITs, other types of investment vehicles, private funds. Anyone who applies leverage to these heretofore risk-free securities, right, treasuries and mortgage backs, is really in a tough spot because they have to make a decision. Do I, you know, let's say we have this rally now. The 10-year is your benchmark, by the way, for pain on all of these securities. If we get down to 3%, that may be a big selling opportunity to clean house.
We're not that
get
far.
Get rid of all of this stuff and go buy higher coupon securities. That may be an opportunity, but I think for a lot of little banks, for example, they don't have the capital to take the losses. And there are some agencies, like the Federal Home Loan Banks, who own this collateral too. We don't talk about that. So the Fed has put stress on the system as they have pursued monetary policy, but they forgot that if they move things too quickly and too much, you know, 6 points, really, then everybody's insolvent.
Is there an investment play for you right now?
Oh, I've been buying bank stocks. I bought some CS, which was clearly a mistake. But I'll keep it and buy some more UBS. They are the last man standing in Europe.
What about regional banks?
I bought Western Alliance. That was one of my favorites. I wrote about them 2 years ago. They went up 200% during the mortgage boom, thanks to Jay Powell. They had bought a portfolio company from Apollo called AmeriHome, mm-hmm. which is one of the most efficient conventional lenders in the country. Really good team, by the way. And I'm looking at New York Community Bank. I've been following them for years. They just bought some of my friends at Flagstar Bank, which is a large mortgage player, second largest warehouse lender in the country after Chase. So there's a lot of deals out there. You know, but you know what? It pains me that I have to wait for deals as a result of policy mistakes.
Right. Which banks are you staying away from? Don't want anything to do with?
Well, look, in 20, I sold all my common, and I went and put my financial allocation into bank preferreds just mm-hmm. so my feet wouldn't get wet. I went higher up the capital structure. I'm starting to nibble on some of these common situations, though, because I love Western Alliance. They're one of the great mortgage shops in the country, wholesale bank. New York Community Bank, I think, is very interesting because they just bought all those assets from Signature.
Right.
When you buy assets from the FDIC, they have no cost basis. Okay?
Yeah, so why not?
Yeah. Yum. So that's going to be very creative for them, I believe.
Chris, just got about 45 seconds. JP Morgan, Citi, Goldman, B of A, they're fine?
Well, Goldman doesn't have the mark-to-market problem because they're a broker-dealer.
Right.
But they have a funding problem, as I've written for my subscribers, because they have to go out and compete with Ally and American Express and everybody else for brokered deposits. They don't really have a strong core deposit base. And I've always argued that David and the boys should go buy a bank. Go buy Key. They love commercial real estate.
Sounds
Goldman
all right
guys
now.
Love commercial real estate, you know?
But the other guys, the other big guys, 20 seconds left, they're not worried about?
Nah, U.S. Bank is the strongest of the top five. You know, they're the littlest money center, but very well run. I don't bother with the others except to buy their preferreds for income.
Listen, so appreciate it. You took me back, and it was so good to reconnect.
I know. We got to do this again, Carol. We can't wait another decade.
Deal. Not another crisis. All right, Chris Whalen, be well. Have a great weekend. Chris is, of course, institutional risk analyst over at Whalen Global Advisors. As I said earlier, worked for the New York Fed, worked for Bear Stearns, worked in up on Capitol Hill, but a great voice for us to check into on certainly this Friday with a lot going on. This is Bloomberg.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. 2 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY.
Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern.
Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app.
Or watch us live on YouTube.
I was just bringing up how Bitcoin closed today. Yeah, we're just below 28,000, although we did see it pop above that. Like it was, I think, early on Monday for the first time since June. We have also seen, Jess, I feel like, the largest digital coin, Bitcoin, and some crypto stocks come back to life this week a little bit.
We definitely have, because there was a particular point when you were looking at the span over the past couple of weeks where it had surged more than 30%. So now the past couple of days, seeing it come back to reality, like you were talking about, still below 30,000, now close to 28,000. But still, it was on a tear despite what was going on with a lot of these banks the past few weeks.
It's kind of interesting, right? Yeah. I mean, the volatility. All right, so let's get to our weekly crypto segment. We reach out to Thomas Crallo. He is an investor, influencer, and trader, founder and CEO of Crallo Enterprises. He joins us via Zoom from Dubai. Thomas, good to have you here on this Friday. Tell us what you make of some of the trade this week when it comes to cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin in particular, and even some of the equity plays.
Yes. Hello, everyone. Thank you very much for having me. Very happy to be here. And quite frankly, this has been one of probably best weeks so far in a very long time when it comes to Bitcoin. And that is because of Bitcoin following global liquidity, and we were seeing Japan injecting liquidity, so is China. And U.S. was taking the liquidity out of the system, but now in light of the collapse of the banking system, we're actually seeing it come back. So those of us who are actually into crypto, this is just a fantastic time.
So let's take a step back, because not all of our audience may be familiar with who you are. So tell us about how you came to invest in the crypto space and how long you've been doing it, and talk to us a little bit about the trades that have been of interest or productive for you specifically.
Sure. Well, I've been into crypto space for a couple of years now. I have about 10-year background in retail trading, but then recently I've transitioned into asset management as well and founded my own hedge fund and a venture fund. And one of the best, I mean, venture fund is probably not that relevant to the current market conditions, but when it comes to the recent plays, we're once we actually figured out that the banks are collapsing and that people are going to be losing faith, just like in 2008, in the banking system, and just the only difference that this time they're going to have an alternative, which is Bitcoin. And this has given us an incredible opportunity to go all long on Bitcoin. So on so far, it's played out really well. We actually are still long on Bitcoin.
And many would argue it's still early in the game. We've had three banks collapse. You know, we're watching. Yeah. So I think, and many that we've talked to say it's not like 08.
I was curious, Thomas, how much money have you actually made in the crypto space? And how specifically have you made that money in crypto? What kind of corners of the market in crypto?
Well, in crypto space, really, there is different ways of making money. Certainly, one of the best, the biggest income that I've had was by simply building a regular portfolio of the assets I believed in back in 2019 and riding this cyclical wave of crypto.
And how much money did that portfolio make?
Well, in percentage terms, it was 2,000%. But money-wise, sadly, I didn't enter with $1 million. So the profit was just a little north of $1 million. So, but for me, it was still quite substantial considering that I didn't expect this kind of a return.
And that was definitely in the early phases of Bitcoin. So how has that evolved to these other coins where you think of maybe some of these more riskier ones like Dogecoin, but then also there's Ethereum. But are those coins that you're trading as well?
For sure. Yes, this is something that, you know, as part of my hedge fund strategy, our main objective is to reduce the risks, which is very strange to say about crypto, and also to outperform Bitcoin returns. So certainly there are, when it used to be all about, you know, crap coins, so to speak, right now, actually, there are quite a few projects out there that offer quite incredible utility and purpose behind them, like Ethereum. You don't have to go far to find one that actually has... Yeah, it's, as a lot of people say, it's ultrasound money, and it's by far more technologically advanced than Bitcoin. But every project, I would say, has its pros and cons. It all just depends on what kind of thing you enjoy most, I suppose.
Last year, when cryptocurrencies came under a ton of pressure, how much money did you lose?
Well, quite frankly, since I'm not just an investor, I am also a trader. So for one, I know how to hedge my risk and how to actually play the market to the downside. That's for one. And number two, my portfolio that I've put together in 2019, I sold it about a couple of weeks before the Chinese FUD, before China actually banned mining, which took Bitcoin down to 30,000 from 60,000. So for I didn't really lose that much. I'd say I started buying back into Bitcoin when it was going back down to 40K, 30K. So I started DCAing. So it's not really about losing money. It's more of
holding. I feel like it is, though. Isn't it? You don't want to lose money.
Yeah, it's very difficult to time the bottom. Who is trying to time the bottom usually doesn't really enter at all.
So I guess, like, to your point, what's the time horizon you're looking at here, right? Like, are we talking a few, 5 years, 10 years, a couple years? Like, what is the trade for you? Because when you think about portfolio managers, they obviously have a particular time horizon as
well.
And
what's the top?
Right, right.
Is there another near-term top? Yeah.
For sure, yes. So when it comes to for Crawlo Capital, as an example, our time horizon is a minimum of 3 years. So everything else is just market frequencies that I certainly enjoy as a retail trader for my personal interest and, you know, sports interest, so to speak. But for our hedge fund, we don't use any leverage, and we just DCA into the assets we believe in. So usually it's a 3-year time horizon, for sure.
Well, so in the last couple of weeks, how actively have you been trading the crypto space?
For our fund, not very, because the last time we actually bought into Bitcoin was at $17,000. That was the last point when we were actually buying into it. For now, I'm holding my horses, so to speak. I want to see as to how the whole situation with the banks is going to play out, and subsequently also regulation. So for now, we are happy with our positions. But when it comes to my personal retail trading, then I certainly am enjoying my long trade, but I'm not looking forward to flipping it short just as of yet, despite the actual Binance suspending withdrawals right now, which is still a big fear. But for now, I'm still long for my personal retail trading side of things.
What specific level for Bitcoin are you watching for a threshold to see when it's reached its near-term inflection point versus stocks?
Yeah, I think that's the most important point. Well, we have to consider also all the regular indicators, which actually point to the fact that Bitcoin is currently has decoupled from S&P 500 and NASDAQ, and really any high-risk asset out there and is outperforming those assets for obvious reasons, I guess, of the banking collapse and stuff. But I think that the most important point in the price for Bitcoin for us to actually, you know, kind of start celebrating is $30,000, and we are fighting fiercely for it right now. We're, well, close to it. So I say once we clear 30K with large amount of volume, that would be something to consider as true reversal, in my opinion.
So we have seen Bitcoin outperform not just stocks, but also when you're looking at the commodity space. What specific risks are you looking at to see if it could upend that particular trade in the near term?
Right. So I would say that there are a few systemic risks when it comes to Bitcoin. Certainly with the current, just the narrative itself, there was also the narrative risk, which actually has been brought down to close to zero right now because of the, again, fall of the banks. But one of the biggest risks currently as we stand is, number one, regulatory. So that could translate into, for example, ban of Binance and subsequent potential crash of Binance, which would just be a huge systemic risk. But besides this, the most biggest one, I think, is Tether. So if Tether, the issuer of USDT, were to be receiving a Wells notice and subsequently cease to exist at some point, this could definitely set us back 5 or even 10 years. Something as crazy as that. So these are two biggest things. No.
All right. Going to leave it there. Hey, Thomas, thank you. Thomas Crallo, he's Chief Executive Officer of Crallo Enterprises, joining us via Zoom from Dubai.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, just about 17 and a half minutes left in today's trading session. Carol Masser along with Bloomberg's Jess Metten. We are live in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio, streaming on YouTube and Bloomberg Originals. And stocks holding on to their gains of the session. It's not gangbusters, but mind you, everybody, we are well off our lows of the session. And Jess, we've got continuing to see that two-year note well below 4%.
Right, and that is, again, been the key indicator. And clearly also, when we're talking about under the hood for the S&P 500, the search for income continues again today when you're looking at the leaders, utilities and real estate. Once again at the top, both of those sectors up more than 2% in the S&P 500.
A telling trade. All right, so let's get to it and let's get to our Drive to the Close guest. Dana DiOria is back with us, co-CIO of the independent investment advisor and Investnet PMC, joining us via Zoom from Pennsylvania. Dana, nice to have you back with Jess and myself. How do you see the trade right now?
Thanks for having me. Yeah, it's really interesting to me, you know, what's the sort of dichotomy right now going on in markets, the fact that we're seeing such resilience and at the same time, you know, banks are really under a lot of pressure. Every new day brings another bank to kind of get the focus and be looked at. And, you know, on the one hand, you could say, well, regulators are successfully, you know, calming markets at a higher level. I think it's hard to kind of listen to comments that, hey, the banking sector is resilient, all will be well, when you're talking about a business that kind of relies on confidence, right? And, you know, even banks that don't have the troubles that in general were brought on by the rate increases, you know, are going to get looked at sequentially, I think. So interesting dichotomy in markets for sure.
Dana, what I'm really curious about is whether or not most of the pain has already been priced in when we're looking at U.S. equities holding up last week as well as this week.
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. And obviously the market is, or it would appear anyway, that the market is expecting, given fixed income rates, expecting that the Fed will have to pivot And therefore, you know, the markets will get their Fed put back into place. You know, it's hard to square that with the fact that you have more jobless claims down. I mean, certainly the unemployment rate not ticking up, and we're not seeing, you know, and these things take effect with a lag. So it's not to say that we won't, but we're not seeing yet the kind of movement in these numbers that would cause the Fed to say, hey, mission accomplished, we need to stop. So my thought is that we may well not have another rate increase, particularly as we see how this banking crisis unfolds, but a pivot just, you know, seems hard to expect where we stand today.
We just had Chris Whalen on, institutional risk analyst over at Whalen Global Advisors. He's somebody who understands the banking sector, the financial sector. We talked to him a lot during the 08 financial crisis. He's an investor, looks for some opportunities within banking. What's interesting is he said the Fed needs to cut rates right now. And he also said it's time for the Fed to just accept that inflation's going to run hot. It's just the way it is, and we'll be okay. Do you agree in terms of the trade? Because right now we're, you know, take out the banking sector, and we were starting to, I feel like, do okay, even though, you know, inflation still ran hot. How do you see that?
I see a pause as being in order. I was on with your colleagues a few days ago before the Fed made its decision. I expected the 25. Sure enough, we got it. I think everybody kind of thought we're probably going to get it. I would say a pause might not have been the worst thing even before then. You know, the problem is that this type of policy, this monetary policy, it affects with a lag, number one. Number two, you're only impacting, or you're most strongly impacting, interest rate sensitive parts of the economy. So you're trying to defeat inflation with, you know, this one sort of, it's a hammer kind of situation, and everything therefore has to become the nail. So I think a pause would absolutely be in order. I know the Fed is concerned about stop and go policy, absolutely concerned about inflation running too hot. We have to consider that inflation may not come out around 2% long term, at least not for the near term. Now, the caveat to that is if we're running at, you know, year over year inflation higher than 3%, 4%, et cetera, of course, we have to keep tackling that. But sort of waiting for the effects of what's already been done before we continue to raise seems like a good policy option for me.
So, Dana, has this trade specifically on Wall Street shifted from, as we know, last year's trade of inflation to now the recession trade?
So we had been there for sure. I think, you know, there was some indications for a long time of peak inflation, and absolutely the market turned its focus to, okay, you know, we're heading now towards the likelihood of recession, if not in 2023, in 2024. Obviously, markets are leading indicators. You know, the impact has not yet hit the job market. That usually takes place, though, significantly after a tightening cycle begins. So the expectation is that we are going to feel the pain of this. You know, interestingly, again, the interest rate sensitive sectors like banks, financials, you're seeing it happen pretty quick and, you know, not surprising in hindsight, right? Given such abrupt and strong increases over time or over the course of a year. But yes, I think the trade has to shift to recession, and we're absolutely looking at that going forward.
All right. So when do markets reprice for that recession? And then what's your strategy ahead of that or at this point? And we've got about a minute to go.
So quickly, you know, margins coming in for companies, right? Earnings seasons that increasingly demonstrate the fragility. You're seeing, for example, tech margins coming in, and yet tech is going strong. Mm-hmm. My quick in the 1 minute is I don't view tech as being the defensive sector that we've all converted it to mentally. I think traditional defensive sectors are a better place, you know, in an environment like this. Consumer staples, a countercyclical, higher dividends, lower beta. Healthcare, you know, largely countercyclical and more attractively priced. Standard, you know, sort of fundamental quality indicators and even low volatility indicators more than tech. would be my play.
All right. Really appreciate it. Dana, have a good weekend. Dana DiOria, she's co-chief investment officer over at Investnet, joining us via Zoom from Pennsylvania.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.